The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
North Carolina under a state of emergency tonight, and police say someone shot up power substations in Moore County, leaving thousands of people in the dark. The outage has forced schools to close tomorrow, and some families are heading to shelters.
The result of an intentional vandalism. The FBI has joined state and local officials in the investigation. No individual or group has claimed responsibility. The county has declared a state of emergency and put in place a countywide curfew to keep people off the roads with no streetlights or traffic signals.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, that was a story that got my attention. And I'll tell you why, and you may not remember this. 9 years ago, there was a strange story that came out of San Jose, California. Sometime during the night, they don't know who did this, but somebody used a high-powered rifle, and they shot out power transformers at an electrical substation. Raised a lot of questions about how vulnerable our power grid could be, whether or not this is a precursor to a much larger terroristic attack. Fortunately, the power company was able to divert power around that particular substation and, you know, to the people who were impacted until the repairs were made. Unfortunately, no one has ever been arrested for that incident. Isn't that bizarre? It was 2013 when that took place. On Sunday, and if you haven't heard this, you should turn up your radio. This is a crazy story. Something very similar happened in Moore County, North Carolina. Only the people in that county, in the center of the Tar Heel State, weren't so lucky as the people in San Jose. Apparently, a couple of electrical substations were targeted, and they were taken out. Right? But the power company doesn't have the capacity to reroute electricity around this problem. So the county's sheriff, he told reporters that the people who did it, now listen to this, he said they knew. They knew what they were doing. You had to know what you had to shoot at. You had to be precise. You had to be, they had sniper rifles. All kinds of law enforcement agencies right now are working on this case, and it's going to take a long time before, of course, those people get their power back up. And I thought, you know, that's somewhere in the middle of North Carolina, right? Moore County. What if you hit a major city? What if you targeted Chicago or L.A. or Philly or New York? You took out some critical infrastructure. I mean, what would that do? Can you imagine the chaos that would ensue? I said to my wife the other day, and I'm not a prepper, I'm not a conspiracist, you know. But I said to her, so, you know, we got to get some water in the house, you know. We need to get some stuff in case power goes out for some reason. I don't know, you know. Law enforcement's working on it. Maybe it's just an anomaly. There are some speculation it could be related to a drag show that was happening in the county. The sheriff said there's no evidence pointing in that direction. Isn't it funny how even, you know, the Colorado gay nightclub shooting was a tragedy. It was a horrible situation. But immediately what happened, the speculation, it was some conservative that came out and did the shooting, and it came out that, no, this person was bi that did this. Clearly the person had mental problems, right? Why are we pointing to people who are against, you know, drag shows? Where's the evidence on that, right? That's what's floating around on the internet, right? Here's the thing, 55,000. Mark that number, 55,000 of these substations all around the country are almost unguarded. Almost all of them are unguarded. The 9 largest ones are guarded, to be fair, because if those are taken out, then almost the whole country is going to be plunged into darkness. Look, we need to harden our infrastructure here anyway. I think we need to harden our power grid, but that's another story. Hardening the ones that we have against this kind of threat, that's a problem because it's going to be very costly to resolve. So I've invited today James Meggs. He's a senior fellow of the Manhattan Institute, a contributing editor of the City Journal and former editor of Popular Mechanics. His coverage of energy and environmental policy and culture and all sorts of other topics that they've appeared in, everything from the Wall Street Journal to the New York Times. And I thought we'd tap into his expertise. He's been following this and get a sense of what's now unfolding. Hey, James, thank you for your writing. Thanks for being here. It's good to talk with you today.
Yeah, it's great to be here, Drew.
This is a crazy story, and again, it could be an anomaly. Maybe we'll see something else 9 years from now. I do worry about our porous border down south. You know, we know fentanyl's coming over. There's people in ghillie suits and camouflage. You can get a terrorist across the border if you wanted to. How vulnerable are we in terms of the scope and the scale of our power grid right now if you can just take a sniper and take out a couple transformers?
We're pretty vulnerable. The fact that somebody could just roll into these substations in rural Moore County and shoot them up and cut off power for nearly 50,000 people. It might have been a single person who did it. Yeah. It is a clue to a vulnerability. You know, our entire infrastructure system partly runs on trust. We assume that there aren't a lot of bad actors out there, and that we don't need to have an armed guard at every one of these facilities. It would be just cost prohibitive. And as you said, there was that very alarming incident in California in 2013. There have been a couple of other more minor ones over the years since. And those are deliberate incidents. There's also the risk of something affecting our power grid that isn't intentional, it's accidental. And unfortunately, our power grid is getting somewhat more vulnerable to those kinds of outages as well. So I agree with you. I think we need to do more to beef up the resiliency of our grid.
I used to have a guest on by the name of Dr. Peter Bry, testified before the Congress many times. He's part of the EMP Commission. He was really worried about our power grid. He says it's vulnerable to terrorist activity, an EMP, solar flare, things along those lines. What is the condition of the U.S. power grid right now? I hear senators and others often talk about how we need to harden it, and there's a new front for warfare, even cyber warfare, that could cripple a nation. How vulnerable are we?
It's hard to put a number on the risk. In some ways, our grid operators have become more cognizant of the threats of cyberware, and they've gotten better at grid resiliency in terms of the knowledge of protecting these systems. But at the same time, our grid is getting more vulnerable for a couple of reasons. One of those reasons is that we're changing the mix of power sources, and we're moving from steady, dependable sources to more erratic, less dependable sources. And there are a lot of reasons that people are advocating wind and solar. The zero carbon output. Yeah, right. When they're operating, they produce very inexpensive power. But it's a huge challenge for the grid to juggle these sources that come on and off at somewhat unpredictable times. So instead of having, in a state, you might have 30 power plants chugging away pretty reliably. And then, during like the peak late afternoon, evening, you bring on a couple of extra gas fire plants to fill the gaps as power demand goes up. Now you've got wind and solar fluctuating all over the region, and you need to juggle other sources. That's a challenge for the grid. It's not necessarily insurmountable, but I think people have underestimated the challenges that creates. And then you have a problem with how we've, in some parts of the country, we've tried to deregulate the grid. So we've separated the business of the people who make power from the business of the people who deliver the power across the power lines to your house. And what that's done is it's kind of removed some of the incentives for keeping our power grid dependable. It was one of those reforms that maybe was made us a little too smart for our own good. Right. And we saw what could happen with that, with the terrible power outages in Texas back in 2021, when there was a severe cold snap and a lot of the power grid went down and people literally froze to death in their homes. So that was not a terrorist or a violent incident, but it showed you that even in a place like Texas that has ample supplies of energy, they weren't ready to handle an unexpected event like this severe cold snap.
Yeah, that was crazy to see that happen in a state like Texas, that seems to have so much, oil and petrol. I was shocked by that, but that was very telling, especially regarding their aspect of their grid. You talked about wind and solar. I mean, that's the big push right now. I know the president wants to get us to reduce our carbon footprint and, of course, to go green. The future of alternative energy, I mean, how far away are we from that And what does that do? We still need a power grid, right? This energy that's now being manufactured via solar or wind or water or whatever you want to use, it still has to be funneled over that same grid, correct?
Yes. I did an article for City Journal last year called The Green War on Clean Energy, and it really got into the ways that some of the policies that we're pursuing are somewhat counterproductive. And I'm not against wind and solar. I think they really have their place on the grid. But I think there are a lot of environmentalists who have been too optimistic that we can run the power grid primarily on these renewable sources and we can get rid of our dependable sources of power. And that would include things like shutting down nuclear power plants, shutting down coal plants. And, you know, the coal plants are a real problem, and it's great to be able to phase them out when we can do so economically. But you can't just take your steady, reliable power sources off the grid and expect wind and solar to make up the gap. The grid is not ready for that. And what's interesting is that some of the same environmentalists who have been supporting the wind and solar for many, many years were also fighting to close down nuclear power plants. Yeah. We see in Germany today what happens when you do that. Yeah. They're in a terrible energy pinch, and they've gone back now after decades of claiming that they were going to be the leaders in greenhouse gas emission reductions. Now they're back to burning coal, you know, big time. So it hasn't worked out very well for them. We're in better shape in this country, and fortunately, there's more consensus now that we need to save our nuclear plants and not shut them all down like Germany did. But we are not in as good a shape as we should be, and there's been too much wishful thinking in our energy policy.
And my guest today, James Meggs, if you want to join us, we only have him for a few minutes, but we'd love to have you pull up a chair. The number here is 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. We're taking a look at the electrical substation that was shot in North Carolina, taking people offline. And what it portends for the future. We're taking a look at the power grid and so much more. You know, I started talking about that situation in 2013, which took place in San Jose. And it knocked out that electrical substation, raised fears that the country's power grid was vulnerable to terrorism. The coordinated assault, if I remember correctly, took out about 17 of these giant transformers that funneled power to Silicon Valley. And it was, at the time, you know, the most significant incident of domestic terrorism involving the grid that occurred. Where are we right now? You know, it's been 9 years between then and what has happened in a rural area across the country. I don't know if you can even answer the question. Do we know what's happened? Has there been any follow-up on that? Does this make sense to you? Do you feel like this is a precursor to something larger?
You know, one hesitates to make predictions about something like this. But after that attack, the FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, took it very seriously and put together a commission. And they came up with a bunch of recommendations and a new regulatory standard called CIP-014, which went into effect in 2015, I think. And that required grid operators to harden their larger substations from this kind of attack. Yeah. And that could include things like making it so that somebody outside the station can't just see through the fence and see where to shoot. Mm. You know, the people who shot up that station in California seemed to know exactly what they were doing. That was one of the scary things about it. So if you can you can disrupt the line of sight, that adds some security. Obviously, we live in an age when there ought to be, you know, plenty of video cameras, constant monitoring of these facilities. It doesn't cost much to, even in places that are out in rural areas, it doesn't cost a lot to set up that kind of surveillance. So the government has mandated that a lot of these substations have been updated. We don't know, maybe about 1,500 of the larger ones have been hardened against attack. The ones that were attacked in North Carolina, probably, from what I'm reading, aren't on that list because they were smaller.
Yeah.
But clearly we need to do more.
All right, let's grab a call or two. Frank is listening to us in Big Sky Country, Montana. Hi, Frank.
Hey, Drew. Hey, agree with everything your guest is saying. Retired power system engineer. There have been a lot of cases of sabotage that you know, people have found, people shooting insulators out, all that other stuff. I work for a major utility. We did all the cyber hardening, you know, 10, 15 years ago, added security cameras to our major substations and all that. But I just want to let you know, anybody with a basic understanding of firearms and a basic understanding of electricity could cause a major outage very easily, and it would be pretty hard to get caught. Although it has happened, but when you're looking at a big transmission line on a major intertie going through Montana, we used to have several incidences where hunters would, or whatever, would shoot out the insulators. And a big problem with that is it's a major intertie. You don't just get a local outage. I mean, it affects a big chunk of the grid in a major area.
Yeah.
Another thing I wanted to bring up, he was talking about the environmental woes. A lot of stuff that we tried to do 30, 40 years ago to build more lines, more power plants, that was all put at bay by the same environmental groups. So the power systems used to have what was called a spinning reserve, where you had about 10% of your generation just sitting there spinning, ready to pick up when you had these outages and things like that. 20, 30 years ago, those things kind of went by the wayside, and they've got smart systems now, remedial action schemes that have allowed the power system be run at the very edge of stability. So when things go, you have these kind of things happen. It's always a crapshoot.
Yep, yep.
But whether you're going to be able to protect the system or not, and then it's going to cascade. So just letting you know, it's what he mentioned about, you know, it's run on trust. You're still going to have all these. You got hundreds of thousands of miles of transmission lines and tons of substations. So.
That's wild. Hey, Frank, thank you. Thank you for the call. Let James respond to you as well. I hear what he says, and boy, he brings up a point. It makes me think, boy, should we be prepping? Should we have water in the house? I always say you should have probably at least 2 weeks' worth of supplies. James, your thoughts on Frank's comments and even, you know, where you are. Do you have stuff in the event something like that happens?
Well, let me respond to Frank first, because he's bringing a wealth of hands-on knowledge to this. And this, what he's saying is exactly right, that we used to run the power grid with a little more slack in it, so that when something went wrong, you were able, you know, you had turbines already spun up, you could turn those generators on quickly to respond. Now we have different ways to do that, and the green energy advocates believe that eventually we'll have all these backup batteries on the system. So when the wind stops blowing, the turbines go down, we'll just turn to these batteries. But that technology is really not there yet, and it's a question whether it will ever really be cost effective. And part of my point in this article, The Green War and Clean Energy, is some of the same people who are advocating wind and solar, but then you need power lines to connect those distant facilities to the grid. And the same people that want wind and solar often fight the power lines. You know, they file environmental lawsuits against the infrastructure we need to deliver that power to customers. So the grid is getting new stresses, and we're not building the infrastructure we need to make it more resilient as fast as we should, partly because of opposition from environmental groups.
Yeah. Hey, what about prepping? I mean, where are you in terms of, when I hear these stories, I'm like, I better get something in the house because I don't have anything right now, but love your take.
I'm a big believer in being ready to handle a sustained power outage in your house. Yeah, I mean, I have a month of food in my house. And you know, it's not a bad idea to have a generator.
I don't mean to step on you, James, but you're saying a month you think is a good number to have, not 2 weeks?
Nobody knows, but you know, what Frank was saying about the vulnerability of the grid, if something goes down, you know, when the grid goes down in one set, in one area, it often does a lot of damage. It takes transformers, blow. They can't just switch it back on. And a really sustained, severe outage, it's conceivable we could have a situation where it would take weeks to get big parts of the country back online. Is it likely? Hopefully not, but it's not. You know, you have smoke detectors in your house, but even though the chance of your house catching on fire is probably one in 10,000, but it's totally worth having smoke detectors.
I think
it's worth having food and being ready for a prolonged outage.
I had this conversation with my wife the other day. I said, honey, we got to get some stuff in. After reading this report, I thought, because I know how devastating it'd be when something like this goes down, it won't take long before people are out of food and water. When heat is off, it could be absolutely crippling, and chaos could certainly ensue. My guest today is James Meggs. We're taking a look at the attack on the North Carolina substation, leaving 45,000 people without electricity. And I'm just wondering what it portends for the future. Was it a terroristic act? Was it some nut job? I don't know. Just went out there to shoot it down. And what do we need to do to be prepared? And how fortified is our power grid? We'll go to Steve in Illinois. He's a retired reactor operator. He wants to join the conversation, James. Steve, good afternoon.
Hi, Drew. I'm a big fan of nuclear power. I worked at a nuclear power plant that had windmills around them. Our capacity factor was over 90% at LaSalle Station. And I truly believe that we need to be heading towards looking at these modular 300 megawatt plants that they're looking into. I think Bill Gates has looked into something like that.
Sure.
And I just don't think the grid would be stable with just windmills and solar panels.
I would agree with you on that. And James, I'll let you respond.
I am 100% on board with that. Another article I did for City Journal a couple of years ago was about this next generation of nuclear power. And this would include what they call small modular reactors, SMRs, and as the caller says, Bill Gates. But lots of other people have been investing in developing these technologies. Fortunately, this is an area of bipartisan agreement. Both Republicans and Democrats have supported research funding for this next generation. Under the Trump administration, under the Biden administration, these projects are moving forward. And in fact, one really good place to put these reactors is right on site where you might have closed down an outdated coal-fired power plant. You know, the power lines are already there. It's in a good location to deliver power to populated areas. Yeah. So these are basically plants that are maybe a third or a quarter the size of a traditional nuclear reactor. They're super safe. And then as you need more power, you can add more of these compact reactors at the same facility. You might put in, depending on the size, you might put as many as 10 in one location. But they're a lot easier to operate. They're built in factories, which means that it's easier to build them with very high tolerances, where it's difficult to do that on site with a traditional large reactor.
Hey, James, I've got to take a short pause. You have a few more minutes to stay? I'd love to talk to you a little bit more. Great. When we come back, if you want to get into, and Todd in Lexington, Kentucky, Vic in Northwest Indiana, everyone else, we'll grab your calls. The number here is 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. I do want to follow up with you too, James, on you were talking about having a generator. We can talk about that as well. But short pause. We'll be back on the other side. There's a lot to talk about. Don't go away.
The Drew Mariani Show.
Hi, Drew. Thank you. Thank you for your show.
This is the Drew Mariani Show.
Marvelous show on the radio right now.
On Relevant Radio. This is the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio and on the Relevant Radio app.
Yeah, hey, thanks for joining me. You're just getting plugged in. I've got a few more minutes with James Meggs, and we are talking about, tens of thousands still in the dark after a very mysterious attack took place on substations, electrical substations in North Carolina. There are no suspects in custody, not even sure the motive. FBI is now joining the investigation into what is happening here. North Carolina, the county is believed to have been, well, there's questions as to whether or not this is a targeted attack and if there's something more to the picture than meets the eye. I don't know. Our conversation, though, is a riveting one. One, if you missed part of it, please go back to our podcast. You can go to Apple Podcast or go to Spotify or to Relevant Radio. Maggie will have this conversation up in about an hour and dive into it. As I said, I'm joined this afternoon by James Meggs, senior fellow of the Manhattan Institute and a contributing editor of the City Journal and former editor of Popular Mechanics and contributor to Wall Street Journal, Slate, New York Times, and an expert on energy and environmental policy and culture. And it's good to have him back with us today. James, before I get into the phones, a lot of great calls, a lot of people, a lot of experience. I want to follow up on this whole prepping issue. You got a month of supplies. Generators. It's one of the things you said. I often see these solar generators advertised. There's gas generators, there's generators along those lines. What kind of generator do you have? If the power was to go out, and you want to at least be able to get your pump to run or your fridge to work or whatever you need, what's your advice there?
Yeah, so I'm not going to make a product recommendation, but I say talk to your electrician about what your minimal needs are in your home before you go out and get a generator. At the bare minimum, you need to be able to keep your furnace running, and paradoxically, your fridge, even though a lot of times it's happening in cold weather, yeah. Keeping the fridge going is key, and a few lights. But increasingly, people are installing these big whole house generators, right. You know, like from Generac or others,
right.
And that's going to, you know, set you back $5,000 or more. But a lot of people are making that an upgrade to homes. You see it a lot in California where their grid has gotten particularly unreliable. It depends on what you can get by with, but you do need to keep heat on and you need to have the basics.
I was just wondering if power grid goes down, right? And we're without power for a couple of weeks or a month, you know, in a worst case scenario, that means you can't go to the gas station and pump your gas either. Cause when the power goes out, those pumps aren't going to work. So you want something, other than gas? I mean,
they have generators that you can hook. If you're on natural gas. You can run your generator on natural gas. That's cool. A great approach. Our, you know, in a really prolonged, terrible systemic collapse, we wouldn't be guaranteed that the natural gas would keep flowing either.
Right.
So, I mean, if we're talking like real apocalypse,
right.
But the point you make is a good one. When one system in our infrastructure goes down, it tends to then start endangering other ones. And if there was a very prolonged power outage, eventually the diesel tanks, you know, that do backup power to hospitals and police stations and other things would run dry. And then it would depend on can the delivery, you know, trucks keep running? Is there power to pump the diesel into the trucks? I mean, when you really start working this out, a worst case scenario, it gets pretty scary. And so the more independent you can be at home, the better.
Yep.
And I think that, you know, it's incumbent on everyone to just make sure you've got the basics covered. And if you have someone in your family who's elderly or, you know, has medical issues, really think through what you would do in a situation where the power goes out for more than, you know, 24 hours or whatever.
Gotcha. All right, let's go back to the phones. Northwest Indiana's up first. Vic, good afternoon.
Hey, how you guys doing tonight?
Great, Vic. Thanks for calling.
Hey, I worked for a power company for 30 years, and I've been on many, many outages. And I don't believe it's as bad as you guys are making it out to be. Number one, when I went down to Miami for Andrews, we were all stationed. We had people there from Hawaii, Canada, whatever. We were all stationed in an area that had power. Just because one section goes out doesn't mean there's not power all the way around it. And as long as the power lines are still up and off the ground, all it is a matter of opening and closing a couple of switches, and you can re-energize those lines as long as they're not going to short out when you re-energize them. So that's the one thing. Why North Carolina hasn't done that, I have no idea. I never worked there.
Yeah.
But even so, there's neighboring towns, if not states, that are going to have electricity. So it's not like the apocalypse where you got to hunker down and spend all this money because you want to. We have to make exceptions to the rule. perfection is a myth, you know? Yeah. So you have to use the one thing that God gave us, which is a brain, and improvise. You know, go visit your friends. I know if I was in the cold, I'd go visit my friends in Florida for a week. Yeah. You know, and you know, when it comes back on, it comes back on.
Well, Vic, I love it. I like your approach, like your attitude towards it. I had a friend who was living in Texas at the time. When their power grid failed, they couldn't get enough gas to get out of the state in their car to leave. So sometimes it is hard to leave. But, James, I'm going to let you respond to Vic. He's worked for the power company. He makes, I think, a decent point.
Well, Vic, that's great. And really, you know, there's nothing like the hands-on experience. So I think that the issue here is, you know, what is the nature of the damage and how many transformers are involved? And what I'm and you could probably know more about this than I do. What I'm reading from Duke Energy in North Carolina is that the transformers at these substations were so damaged that it's a pretty big job to swap in new ones, and that's why they're saying it's still going to be a few more days before they get that fixed. And we don't have a lot of extra transformers laying around. You know, we were talking earlier about this, how our energy grid runs with a little bit less of a reserve than it used to. There's also, we don't have a big reserve of transformers. So if we have a lot that are damaged at once, that becomes a challenge to bring it back. But yeah, I'm always impressed with the way that the utility industry nationwide mobilizes when there's a hurricane or a big storm. I live in the Northeast, so I saw it after Sandy, and you know, it feels good to see those trucks rolling in from other states, sometimes hundreds of miles away, often just to be prepared when there's a major storm coming. So there's a lot of strength in the system too, but I think we could do better.
Hey, Vic, thanks for your service and thanks for the call. It's good to hear from you. I appreciate that. Just due to time, I'm going to move along, try to get a few more people on the air. Christina's in Silicon Valley. Christina, hi, you're on the air with James Meggs.
Hi, thanks for taking me too.
You're welcome.
I wanted to ask the guest a question. I had read that the problem that happened in Texas with their deep freeze a couple years ago where people died was because they contracted with solar and wind vendors, but the contracts did not include a clause where if they could not provide power, that they had to provide backup power. So there was power of some sort coming from those sources. And I don't know if that's true or not. And I think they have changed that now, but maybe your guests could shed some light on that.
Yes, Christine, that is a, there's a lot of truth to what you're saying. Texas is one of the regions that has gone to a market-based energy system. Instead of the old model where you had a public utility regulated where, you know, the same company owned the power plant, they owned the wires, they distributed the power to your house. Now that in Texas, they've divided it up into different companies, and then all these different power producers are supposed to basically say, okay, we can provide, you know, X kilowatts at X cents, in, you know, right now or in an hour. And that's supposed to be a more competitive system that drives down prices. It's more efficient, but there's no one who's paid to keep it reliable. Yeah. And that's what happened in Texas. There was no one's interest to have backups. And one of the weird things that happens when you bring a lot of wind and solar on the grid, and you're seeing this in California, they can make money, if they only operate part of the time, and they can sell their power, and of course they get large subsidies, but what happens is as you bring more wind and solar, more dependable sources like coal plants or nuclear plants tend to struggle. But if those guys go out of business, you still might have wind and solar producing cheap power when they produce it, but when they don't produce it, you're left without that backup. Now, typically we use natural gas for that backup in a lot of the country, but the entire system is running closer to the edge then. And I think that's what we saw in Texas The cold impacted everything. It hurt the wind. It also, some of the gas pipelines shut down because they weren't ready for the cold. And even the big piles of coal where they had coal plants, they were frozen. their bulldozers couldn't dig up the coal to get them into the plant. I mean, they were just not ready for the cold. And there was not enough resiliency, not enough backup in the system.
Well, James, I have to have you back because it's a great conversation. There's a lot of calls. One gentleman from Lexington, Kentucky was saying, what about electric cars? Imagine if everything is electrified and we lose our power grid, what that would do for the culture as well. And to our caller, Vic, who worked on power lines, he says, I don't know why they just didn't reroute. I was just looking at an article here. It says the damage had been so significant and rerouting the power was not an option. Equipment had to be replaced. So they were pursuing multiple paths of restoration so they could restore power, but it's a pretty sophisticated repair. So that's why they haven't flipped the switch, Vic, but appreciate it. Hey, James, if people want to follow you, get plugged into your work, what's the best way to do that?
Yeah. Well, I write for, as you said, City Journal, and that's a great place to follow all kinds of news about energy and policy. And I am on Twitter at James B. Meigs. That's James, middle initial B, and my last name is M-E-I-G-S, James B. Meigs. Probably not the most convenient Twitter handle ever invented, but that's me. And always happy to engage with people who've got insights and questions.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Hey, we'll catch up again soon, I hope, okay? James, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
It's my pleasure, Drew.
That's James Banks. Got to take a short pause. When we come back, I'll bring you up on one final story here, the Twitter files. Wait till you hear this. Stay with me. I'll be right back.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
We receive hundreds of your phone calls every day, all thanks to the Catholic Order of Foresters studio line. Our sponsor offers flexible life insurance and annuities. Visit relevantradio.com/Forester today. An Illinois Life Insurance Society, not available in all states.
Taibbi claims that Twitter staff had an open line of communication to both the Trump White House and to the Biden campaign at the time. And he says that both camps pretty often reached out to Twitter to either block stories or tweets they felt were unfair, inaccurate, or straight up misinformation. Now, Twitter does have a content moderation team that evaluates those requests, but Taibbi makes the claim that that system was unbalanced in favor of left-leaning requests because Taibbi argues Twitter staff leans left.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Well, big news again from Elon Musk. He released documents showing that Twitter executives regularly met with the Biden campaign to censor stories like the Hunter laptop issue. You think, everybody's heard about that. No, not really. My wife and I were home over the summer, right? And we went to a wedding somewhere, right? So the people at the table we were sitting with, cousins or whatever it might have been, right? We got into kind of a political discussion and somebody brought up, did you hear about Hunter Biden's laptop? And half the table didn't. And I thought, you gotta be kidding me. This was news before the election. Nobody knew. During the election years, it's expected that, we're going to get that old October surprise. That's what they call it, right? News that's going to upset whatever the current trajectory, for the vote is. 2020, it looked like the New York Post had the perfect October surprise. Hunter Biden, right? The son of the former vice president, then candidate for president, dropped off a laptop for repair at a repair shop. And the shop owner, like many other computer repair places, had a policy that, if you leave this more than 6 months, then the item becomes the shop owner's property. So come back, pay your bill and pick it up. Otherwise, it's mine. That's what happened with Biden's laptop. He dropped off a couple Macs, never picked them up. The shop owner decided, let me just see what's inside of this thing. And made a copy of the drive. And what he saw was stunning. He made copies of this drive, gave it to the FBI, right? The Federal Bureau of Investigation. He gave the other one to the New York Post. And I'm glad he did that. They verified the whole story. They started publishing some of what was on the laptop. This was late October in 2020. And it was clear that the contents on the computer, if they came to light, would implicate Joe Biden. It at least cast a shadow of criminal activity? Was he the big guy? You know, was he somehow connected? Was he compromised by China and by some of the dealings of his son? If that got out, it would clearly damage his ability to become president. And subsequently, there have been polls that have been done saying, hey, if you'd known about this prior to the election, would you still have voted? People said no. Could it have changed the outcome? I don't know. He didn't fear anything. Twitter, Facebook, traditional left-wing media, they came to his rescue. You probably remember the stories, right? Algorithms, everything, just totally shut it down. It was fake news on all the liberal media outlets claiming information had been hacked. It was disinformation from Russia. You know, and I said to my wife the other day as I was going through some of this, I said, you know, this does not make America stronger. When we don't report the news objectively and fairly and truthfully, it weakens our nation. Doesn't make us stronger, right? So now you got Elon Musk. He buys Twitter, right? He's releasing the files related to this whole debacle, and the media is going crazy. They're nuts. They can't believe this. It's eye-popping for them, right? Very clear collusion between Biden and Biden campaign and Twitter. There's also collusion with the FBI. The FBI, right? So we learned separately that the FBI was meeting with big tech firms during the 2020 during that year to discuss so-called disinformation. I'm joined today by Jake Denton. He's a research associate in the Tech Policy Center at the Heritage Foundation. I invite him to give us some perspective on the scope and the magnitude of what is now coming to light. And Jake, it's great to have you with me. Good afternoon.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So a big story coming to light. I mean, again, it's so frustrating for me with a journalistic background to see how the media conducted themselves and what a disservice it is both to the American people and our nation and our democracy. They talk about democracy being under attack. This is a real attack on our democracy. Do we know yet anything that's on this laptop? You know, what's out there? How far up the chain at Twitter did the problem go as well?
Yeah, so these Twitter files that came out basically revealed that the most senior levels of the C-suite, with honestly a surprising exception of Jack Dorsey, the at the time CEO, were pretty much aware of this operation to suppress the Hunter Biden laptop story coming out of the New York Post. They had supposedly been tipped off from the FBI, said that there was a hacked story coming through and, you know, to be aware. I think, well, you know, one of the funnier parts of this whole thing is they used the word warned, which, you know, depending on the context you want to give that, it could mean, you know, a threatening warning versus, you know, just a nice, lighthearted, hey, it's coming your way type of thing. But, you know, they get the warning and then sure enough, they go through internal communications, you know, right on their company emails. There was really no concern about anyone ever finding this. And they basically lay out a plan as to how they could derail this story and make sure no one sees it.
Wow. Do we know how closely, let's say, the Biden campaign in particular, executives there at Twitter were working together?
Yeah, so the emails kind of allude to a much more friendly relationship than they may have revealed, you know, in the release. So he says another dump from the Biden campaign, something along those lines, implying, you know, several of these have come through earlier. There is a sign there that there is a close relationship between the Biden camp and the Twitter trust and safety team at the time. And I think what's, you know, important to remember here is the trust and safety team is comprised almost entirely of Ivy League kids who went to, you know, social justice type majors. They all worked on these campaigns and then they find themselves in Silicon Valley. So it's really no surprise. Those relationships were established.
You know, the other disturbing aspect of this is the FBI's role in all this. You know, maybe you can expand on that. How significant, how deep was the FBI's role in all of this?
Yeah, I think it's important for that question to take a step back because just a couple of months ago, we saw from Attorney General Eric Schmidt, now Senator-elect Eric Schmidt down in Missouri, he revealed extensive communication from the executive branch in the Biden White House with Facebook, you know, all sorts of social media companies there in Silicon Valley. Flash forward, you know, maybe 1-2 months later, we get a report basically exposing that DHS and Department of State and others had essentially a portal created for them at Facebook and other social media to get direct access to user data. And then you go to this story now where we're seeing that the FBI had essentially briefings, situation reports for Twitter staff, letting them know it was coming that way. They also had, this has kind of gone under the rug a bit, James Baker, the actual deputy counsel from the FBI, had moved over to Twitter. He ran the Russiagate investigation, and now he's supposedly, you know, basically acting as a liaison in this manner to make sure the communications are all streamlined and that FBI message can make it through. So I think this story, you know, the way it's framed, the way it's told, FBI component is absolutely critical. I think it really paints the full picture of how this happened.
It's fascinating. They had a portal and to access that data. That's actually frightening. You know, and but we're pointing at Twitter right now and the FBI, but Twitter wasn't alone in this suppression of what was really a critical election for the electorate. Facebook did the same thing, you know, and all the press joined in. They shut this story down, you know, claiming that the New York Post, they're victims of Russian disinformation. I'd love to go back and look at the video of some of these newscasts, you know, who just totally would not even report or downplayed the story. Do you think we'll ever get an apology from them? And is Facebook going to be held accountable as well?
I don't think there will ever be an apology. I don't think these people have that in them. I don't think they could ever get in front of a camera and, you know, say they're sorry to the American people. I don't think they have any emotions. They're mostly robots. But, you know, then you ask, you know, is Facebook ever going to have this moment? And honestly, unless there's a big leak, they're never going to do this themselves. And our lawmakers, frankly, don't seem too, you know, anxious to go through and comb through it themselves. So we're basically left waiting for a rogue employee to leak this type of thing. And it's very unlikely. I think Facebook is a lot better at, you know, basically locking these things down and making sure info doesn't get out.
Do you think this affected the election? Did you think, I don't know, maybe it did. It's probably a hard question to answer. But, you know, there have been studies or surveys done later asking people, if you knew this information before, would you have voted for Joe Biden? And, of course, a number of people said no. What impact did these algorithms, the FBI, Twitter, Facebook, what role did they play in influencing the election?
Yeah, well, you know, the election was essentially decided by less than 50,000 votes in a couple of swing states. And then, you know, if you consider the story, right, I mean, the way that they went about basically siloing this off from the rest of the internet, the average person, as you highlighted kind of in your opening monologue of this segment, didn't really get to see this. You know, you could scroll them through a grocery store, sit down at the family table, and, you know, quite a few folks haven't actually heard this story. And it directly implicates, you know, the character of the Biden family. You know, it reveals their business dealings, and it basically shows that their son is a crackhead degenerate. Yeah. And, you know, the American people, I'd like to give them the benefit of the doubt that they wouldn't vote for something like that. So, you know, if the story really did actually hit the airwaves and everyone saw it, I think it probably ends up a different direction. Yeah.
So is there a ground, I don't know, for a First Amendment lawsuit here? We're talking about the federal government colluding with private companies to suppress speech of people who are posting online. Twitter wouldn't even let people send the link via direct message. I mean, it was pretty extreme. Do you see anything coming down the pipeline like that?
You know, if we're really able to prove this kind of FBI relationship here, where they were, you know, asking for certain pieces of information to get taken down, or, you know, if we have in the second wave here where they reveal COVID files potentially, if we see that the Biden White House was actually directing certain posts to be taken down, as we already know they are doing with Facebook, right. I think there's absolutely merit for that type of First Amendment suit. You know, they weren't just targeting journalists. They were deplatforming ordinary Americans, you know, people like your listeners. And people need answers for that. We need some justice.
So I've got less than a minute to go. People want to read your work or get plugged in or follow you. What's the best way to do that?
Yeah, you can find me at RealJDenton on Twitter. And then at the Heritage website, I just put out a piece with the National Pulse talking about Elon Musk's battle with Apple and kind of how the Chinese Communist Party is involved with that. So go check that out. That's on the kind of front page of my Twitter at the moment.
All right. And again, that's Real J. Denton, right? At Real
J.
Denton?
Yeah, the letter J. Yeah,
right,
the letter
J. You got it. Thanks, Jake. Great to have you here with us today. I appreciate your insight. Great conversation. I got to leave it there.
Absolutely. Thanks.
I am out of time for the day. I want to thank you for allowing me to be part of your afternoon. I'll be back again tomorrow. If you enjoy the show, make sure you tell others. Anything you missed, check out our podcast. Until tomorrow, God bless.